And we're going to be looking at the last half of this chapter tonight as we continue thinking about some leadership lessons that we can learn from Ezra and Nehemiah. Just by way of kind of a scheduling note or two, next Wednesday, Brother Keith Greer is going to be here, and he is going to give a presentation on his trip a couple of months ago to the Philippines. He came, I don't remember when it was, last year or year before, and gave us a report on that. So you can look forward to hearing him during this time period. The following week, the first Wednesday in December, we will be back in Nehemiah, and I have those question sheets available in the foyer. We're going to be looking, at least I have tentatively planned chapters 4 and 6. I don't know if we'll get through all of that or not. But you can pick up one of those sheets and be ready to discuss that in a couple of weeks. So we're thinking this evening here from chapter 2 about leaders communicating a clear vision to those who are following them, setting a clear plan of action before them. We looked last week at the prayer that Nehemiah offered, that great prayer. He was asking God to take notice not only of himself, but also other faithful Jews that were living perhaps in Jerusalem, and wanting God to hear their prayer, to answer their prayer, and especially at the end of that prayer, at verse 11 of chapter 1, he was wanting God to give him success, or as he went before King Artaxerxes, that he would have a favorable response. We read really that conversation that ensued in chapter 2, verses 1 through 8, that it really wasn't the protocol for anyone who was sad, disheartened, had a sad countenance to appear before the Persian kings. But Nehemiah had already prayed about that to God, and it seemed like he was a man of courage. And he took advantage of this opportunity that he had before the king to kind of lay out his plan before King Artaxerxes and what he intended to do. And so the king was very favorable to his plans. He told him that he could go. And he sent him with some letters, sending him with the authority of the king as he was traveling back to the land of Judah and Jerusalem. Verse 8 tells us, or at least Nehemiah says there at the end of that verse, that the good hand of my God was on me. It kind of reminds me of what Ezra said to us back in Ezra chapter 7. You know, neither one of these men could be the leaders that they were, certainly without God behind all of this. And so God may not be, you know, out in the forefront in all of these things that we're reading about here, but he certainly, I believe, in his providence is working all of this out, not only for the good of these two men, but the good of his people that have come back to Jerusalem. So, again, we're going to be looking this evening at verses 11 through 20. We are thinking here about Nehemiah coming back to the city of Jerusalem as we kind of ended the class last week, as he says there at verse 11, that he was there for 3 days. And it seemed like that he was taking that time perhaps to continue praying about this matter, maybe to talk to those Jews that had been living here in the land for some time to get a better feel of what was going on. But then he went out at night with just a few men that he chose and an animal that he rode on, and he began to go around the city walls. And that's really what we want to think about this evening. And so let's read here again, just to refresh our memories from last week, verses 12 through 16, talk about that a little bit. He says, I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem, and there was no animal with me except the animal on which I was riding. So I went out at night by the valley gate in the direction of the dragon's well and on to the refuse gate, inspecting the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were consumed by fire. Then I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was no place for my mount to pass. So I went up at night by the ravine and inspected the wall. Then I entered the valley gate again and returned. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done, nor had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work. So I think we mentioned this again at the end of class last week. You know, Nehemiah going out at night, I don't think it was because he was afraid or he was scared. He seems to be a man of great faith in God, a man of great courage. Just the fact that he's coming back here to Jerusalem, I think shows those that he had those two qualities about him. But he was wanting to get out and see things for himself before he proposed a plan of action to the Jews here. So the Bible tells us there at verse 13 and 15 that he went out to inspect the city walls. At least that's the word that the New American Standard uses. That word, according to Strong's and also Brown, Driver, Briggs, means to scrutinize. It is kind of a medical term about probing a wound. It is really getting down close and examining things for yourself. And so, you know, he wasn't going to just take someone else's word for it. I think really is the point here, that he was going to do a careful inspection, a careful examination himself. And so he's traveling along the wall here. And if you notice several of these gates, places that he mentions on the wall, that he went out by the Valley Gate. If you have maybe a map in your Bible of the city of Jerusalem, that would have been on the kind of the western side of the city. And it seems like he goes out on the western side, turns left, and then goes around the southern end, comes up on the eastern end. I'm not exactly sure if he went in maybe a gate on the east side or he had to turn around and come back. But nevertheless, again, the point here is that he wanted to see firsthand for himself just how damaged the city wall of Jerusalem was. And as we read there from verse 14, that he got to this certain point there by the king's pool, and he said that the devastation was so great that there was not even enough room for his animal to pass. And so it seems like perhaps he got off of the animal that he was on and just went a ways along the wall on foot so that he could see again for himself. Derek Kidner, in his book on Ezra and Nehemiah, made this comment here about a possibility for verses 14 and 15 when he got to a certain point in the wall and couldn't go past. He said the obstruction may well have been the huge spill of rubble, evidently from Nebuchadnezzar's assault. So when King Nebuchadnezzar had come in and destroyed Jerusalem, perhaps there was a pile of stones, a pile of rubble here. And so the point here again is the devastation is very severe. This is going to be a massive undertaking. This is not going to just be something that's going to be repaired overnight. And we find over in, I think it's in chapter 6, that it took them 52 days, chapter 6 and verse 15, to complete this work. So as you think about what he was doing during the night, can you see any things here that in this section 12 through 16, anything you can think about that would help us to understand his leadership or maybe some quality or characteristic, some lesson we can learn from his leadership? Yes, sir, Brother Duke.
I think one reason he probably went by night is for not to be distracted with other people. He could concentrate on his task ahead and put the plan in his mind and have a good ideal of how to get started. You need some alone time sometimes.
Right. You know, and he would have had to have taken some kind of lighting with him to be able to see all the destruction for himself. So even in going out at night, I think that shows he was thinking ahead. You know, he had a plan for that. It seems to me Nehemiah was a man that always had a plan. Whatever the situation that came up, he was ready to deal with it. And I think that's because, as we've already talked about with him and with Ezra too, that he spent a lot of time in prayer to God. And so I believe he was doing all of this based on the guidance that he was receiving from Jehovah. Somebody else? Go ahead.
I just thought of something. Another thing, this tells us that he knew something about the city before he got there.
Okay.
He he had some foreknowledge of the city. I think this was his first time.
As far as I know.
My understanding.
But, that's a good point.
He had some, he knew where he was going.
All right. And that's a key point for any of us, but especially for those who are leaders. You know, as I think we've already mentioned, or perhaps maybe we mentioned last week, even though Nehemiah certainly is a Jew, he could be seen as kind of an outsider here. You know, he's been living in Babylon. He's been living in Susa. I assume that being the cupbearer to the king, he's had a pretty good life, probably had all of his needs taken care of. But here he is, you know, coming in as an outsider. And rather than just jumping right into it, you know, he was waiting these 3 days. He was wanting to go out at night and see all of this for himself, so that when he proposed the plan that he did to these Jews that were living here in Jerusalem, that perhaps that wouldn't be an obstacle for him to overcome. So I think he showed a lot of wisdom in doing that. You know, as Brother Duke said, a lot of foresight in the way he went about things. Brother Kurt?
We know that the Israelites were, the Hebrews were slaves to the Egyptians, and they built the buildings and laid the brick and all that. Did they do work like that when they were in bondage with the Babylonians? Do we know that?
I don't know. Not to that extent, anyway.
Yeah.
You know, I think they were just a captive people. Maybe somebody else has some other information about that. So, again, I think he showed the quality of courage, leaving his comfortable life in Persia behind, even though he's traveling with some of the king's soldiers here, you know, kind of putting his life on the line, risking his own safety to come into Jerusalem to go out again to look at the walls at night. He showed a lot of courage in putting together a plan to rebuild the city walls. But he also showed, I believe, humility and selflessness. You know, as we mentioned, I think maybe just in passing last week from verse 12, as Nehemiah is writing this, he says that he didn't tell anyone what God was putting into his mind to do for Jerusalem. He wasn't coming back to make a name for himself. He was coming back to do something for God. He was coming back to do something for God's people. And so that really was his focus, that he wanted to rebuild the walls around God's city. You know, that was, Jerusalem really was God's city. That's where his name would dwell among his people. And he wanted to come back to do something for God's people. And so those characteristics of humility and selflessness are certainly vital to godly leaders even today. So anybody else have something that you want to mention there from 12 through 16? Go ahead, Kathy.
I think you touched on it before, but, you know, he could have come in here and told the people, okay, the king sent me, the walls are to be rebuilt, and then he could have asked the leaders, what is the condition? Mm-hmm. What's it like out there? What needs to be done? And then started delegating, but he made sure he knew firsthand what the circumstances were and what the vision of the work was to be done.
Yes, and I think we're going to see that here more in the words that he communicates to the Jews here in the next verse. Like we talked about with Ezra, like we've already talked about with Nehemiah and his prayer. They were trying to identify, you know, with the Jews. They were trying to take ownership, as we might say today, of this particular situation. And as you said, he didn't come in and just say, well, this is a big problem. This wall, you know, everything I've heard about it is exactly right. It's even worse maybe than he had heard. But you guys take care of it. He was very much going to be involved in this rebuilding process. So I think that's very important for leaders, you know, us as husbands and fathers, if we see a problem in our family, if we see a problem with our children at home or with our wife, that we don't just say, okay, we recognize the problem, but then leave it to the rest of our family to solve that problem. Leaders of God's people, the same way. You know, we have to be involved in that. So, again, I think there's just a lot of good characteristics that we can learn from these two men. Let's look here at verses 17 and 18. And Nehemiah says, "Then I said to them, 'You see the bad situation we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach.' I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me, and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. Then they said, 'Let us arise and build.' So they put their hands to the good work." So he's already gone out at night. He's come back into the city. He knows the extent of the damage. He knows just how much work needs to be done. And again, he uses these words there in verse 17. He says, "You see the bad situation that we are in. Come, let us rebuild the city. Let us not be a reproach to the people living around us." And so again, he was trying to identify, I think, with his fellow Jews. It is very impressive how he went about this. He just spoke very candidly and openly and honestly about the situation. He didn't try to sugarcoat it. He didn't try to make it seem like it's not as big of a problem or not as much work going to be needed to fix the walls. He said, the situation's bad. The city is desolate. You know, the walls are broken down. The gates are burned with fire. Again, he was just keeping everything very real for those who were going to be working on the wall. At the same time, though, even though he says this situation is very severe, if you look at the end of verse 17, you know, he could have just seen the situation as being hopeless. There's nothing we can do. You know, I might as well just turn around and go back to Susa. And you go back to living your own life. But he realized that there was hope for this situation. Again, together, they would rebuild Jerusalem's wall so that they would no longer be a reproach among the people that were living around them. And it's kind of interesting that he brings up that particular reason there at the end of verse 17, because if you go back to chapter 1 and verse 3, this is what Hanani and the other men that came from Judah had said to him originally, that the remnant there in the province who survived the captivity are in great distress and reproach. So it didn't seem like it was his, you know, his main concern was not that the people were not living in a fortified city, you know, that they weren't in a place of safety. His main concern was, how do they appear to other people that are living around them? And again, I think he's concerned because they're God's people. This is a remnant of God's people that have returned to God's city. That's the way I think he would have looked at it. This is kind of jumping ahead a little bit, but if you look over in chapter 5 and in verse 16, Nehemiah says here that I also applied myself to the work on this wall. We did not buy any land, and all my servants were gathered there for the work. So he wasn't, again, a leader that was just telling these people, you need to get to work. He wasn't just laying out the plan and saying, here's all the work you have to do. He was getting in there and being involved himself. He was working as well. And so that certainly is a sign of a good leader too. So how did the people react when they heard what Nehemiah wanted them to do? What do we read there in verse 18?
They agreed. They said, let's do it.
All right. What did you say, Brother Duke?
I said, let's get it.
All right. Let us arise and build. I mean, it kind of reminds me of what, you know, what we looked at a few weeks ago with Ezra back in chapter 10 when he presented the sin that was there among them of marrying the foreign women. Verse 12, the people replied, that's right. As you have said, so it is our duty to do. There was a few verses down from that we read of a few Jews that opposed that work. And we're going to look here in a few minutes at verses 19 and 20. There was some opposition to what Nehemiah was proposing, the work that he was proposing. But for the most part, the people accepted his plan because I think he had gone to great lengths to research it, to see for himself, to pray about it, and to present it in a very wise way. And so all of that helped the people, I think, to be convinced, as even Nehemiah says there in verse 18, that this project had the backing of God, this had the approval of God. It also had the approval or favor of King Artaxerxes. And that gave the people a lot of confidence that they could rebuild the wall. You know, if some of these people, I don't know how long they had been living here, but, you know, many years prior to this, they had wanted to rebuild the wall. And they had been opposed on several occasions. So Nehemiah, I think, is instilling confidence in them again that they can do it, that with the Lord certainly behind them and this being something that the Lord wants to be accomplished, that they can rebuild that wall. And so it seems like to me that this is just a time of great unity. And that's what great leaders do, that they are able to unite people, bring people together for a common cause, for a common work. So they didn't just say, let us arise and build, and then they all went home. But the end of verse 18 tells us that they put their hands to this good work. I was planning to spend a class on Nehemiah chapter 3. And that chapter is just a whole list of names that I don't know how to pronounce. But if you have taken the time to read, or even if you haven't, maybe sometime you can look at that, because there's a lot of good information here. Just a few things to point out here from Nehemiah chapter 3. I think this really is, you know, a follow-up to the people having this mindset, let's put our hands to the work. Let's get to work, and they got right to work. So notice here in chapter 3, there's just a long list of names, a lot of different Jews that were involved in working on the wall. And notice also here that there were some officials. I mean, there were some people who were leaders that worked on the wall. Right out of the gate in chapter 3 and verse 1, it tells us Eliashib the high priest. So here is a man who has devoted himself to the service of God, to offerings and sacrifices, to religious things. And the first name that Nehemiah tells us is the high priest, that he arose with his brothers, the priest, and they built the sheep gate. They consecrated it and hung its doors. Again, if you have a map of the city of Jerusalem, the sheep gate would have been very close in proximity to the temple. And so I think the point here is, and really all throughout this chapter, that there were people who were working on sections of the wall that were important to them, that had some meaning or some significance to them. But the high priest didn't say, "Do you know who I am? I'm the high priest. You know, I shouldn't be out here laboring with my hands." No, he was there among these workers as well. I'm just pulling out a few different kind of highlights here. If you want to mention something from verse 3 or chapter 3, that's fine. Let's see, down in verse 8, we read about some goldsmiths that helped to repair the wall, some perfumers. So goldsmiths would have had some skills to work with, you know, maybe iron tools or those kind of things. It would have been very, very precise work that they did, but I don't know that they had necessarily the skills to work on a city wall. Go ahead, Brother Jim.
You talk about the priest working on the sheep gate, which is close to the temple. As you go through this chapter, you find so many people working on the wall next to their house. And another interesting thing is that there are people from the other communities or towns round about that came, from Jericho, Tekoa, and so forth. And so it wasn't just the people in the city of Jerusalem. They were coming from all around to help.
That's a good point. And I think that speaks to Nehemiah's leadership as well. You know, just how great of a leader that he really was to pull those folks in. Todd, did you have a thought?
Just exactly what you're saying. I mean, there's a reference there, 1,500 meters, which is almost a mile. And think about, and you had mentioned earlier, 52 days. Think about how long it would take to build that type of structure today. There's no way it would be done in a month and a half.
And
with all the equipment we have these days.
That's true.
We're doing it by hand, so.
That just shows you how focused these people were on rebuilding the wall.
There again reflects the leadership, right?
It does. And they're able to do that. This is the lesson 2 weeks from today, chapters 4 and 6, with a lot of opposition. So that just, you know, again, that shows us how dedicated they were to this particular work. Again, verse 9, we read about this man who is the official of half the district of Jerusalem, that he made repairs to the wall. As Brother Jim pointed out, verse 10, we have this man who made repairs opposite his house. Let's see, down, I think, verse 23, 28, 29, 30, is all people that really worked on the wall that was in front of or close to their house. Verse 12 is kind of interesting. This man, Shalom, it says he was official of half the district of Jerusalem. He made repairs, he and his daughters. So it was not just men, Jewish men working on the wall. We have women that are working on the wall as well. Everybody, I think, to me, I get that picture of unity, that everybody is involved. A little bit of opposition, but for the most part, everybody is involved in this great work. Isn't that true, you know, as we think about it in our physical families? We really need everybody on the same page. We need everybody working together for the same common goal. In a local church, that's certainly the case. You know, it's not the case that there are some members in a local church who aren't important. You know, think about 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Some of the parts of the body that we may count as not as seemly or not as important sometimes, Paul makes the point there, they are very important. Every part of Christ's body is vital to the overall work that we are trying to do. And so how important it is for all of us to be working together in the work that God has given us to do. Again, you can just read through this chapter. There are a lot of officials that are mentioned here, political, religious officials. And it just goes to show that, you know, Nehemiah was able to rally all these people together. And he was able to set the work before them and to be right there alongside them, working beside them. But also to organize this whole thing. And as Brother Todd said, it's amazing that it was completed in 52 days. To me, that, as Nehemiah was convinced, that shows God was behind all of this. You know, and if we are very dedicated to the work that God has given to us, we're not going to lose. You know, we may accomplish even more than we think is possible on our own and in a shorter amount of time and do a lot more good if we will just trust in God and get to work. Brother Duke?
Psalms 127:1 comes in here. You know, this, the Lord builds a house, they labor in vain. And also Romans 8, verse 31, you know, if God's on our side, we are able to do it. So we have those principles all through the Bible there. We need God. We need to be next to Him. And another thing I thought was interesting, when Eliashib, that high priest.
Yes, sir.
His son, grandson, was married to the opposition's daughter. I thought that was kind of interesting there. We'll find that out as we go along, but you're probably going to bring that up.
Yeah, I think that's in maybe in chapter 4.
Chapter 13, I believe.
Chapter 13, okay. I guess I was looking at the end of chapter 6 mentioned some other people that were married to the opposition as well.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking about at the end of chapter 6.
But Sanballat, you know, was the leader in the opposition, right? He's got married connections with the high priest. Mm-hmm. It's stuff that ever said.
It is. Very interesting. So does anyone have anything else that you want to mention, verses 17 and 18? All right, well, let's look here at verses 19 and 20. And we're going to see not only did Nehemiah communicate to his fellow Jews that were going to work on rebuilding the wall, but he had some communication with his enemies as well. And verse 19 is where the Duke was talking about, tells us about Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, Geshem the Arab. When they heard about what Nehemiah's plan was and the people's response to that, Verse 19 says that they mocked us, they despised us, and said, "What is this thing you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" So I answered them and said to them, "The God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we, his servants, will rise and build, but you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem." And so here were these three enemies of Nehemiah, which really were enemies of God, I think. They were belittling the vision that Nehemiah put forth. They were mocking the people's determination to rebuild the city walls. And really trying to do that, insinuating that their actions were acts of rebellion against King Artaxerxes. Of course, you know, as we read back in verses 9 and 10, when Nehemiah came here to the land as he was traveling, that he was passing out these letters to the governors of the different provinces as he went along the way. And at least a couple of these men were in positions of leadership, political leaders. And so I assume they would have gotten these letters as well. But it's kind of interesting to me anyway that they were saying, you know, trying to discourage Nehemiah and all of these workers from even starting the work on the wall by saying, "This is in opposition to the king, and he's going to deal with you." But how Nehemiah responds to that in verse 20, he doesn't mention anything about King Artaxerxes. You know, he doesn't mention anything about the king's authority. He was coming, and they were all working on this project because he had authority from the king. Again, back to verse 9 of this chapter. But he didn't answer these critics or these enemies by appealing to the king's authority. Rather, he answered them by appealing to the king's authority. He was appealing to God's authority because he says there that the God of heaven will give us success. That again, is where his focus was, where his mind was upon God. And he was a very devoted servant of the Lord. He also says here in verse 20 that we are his servants. We are servants of the Lord God Most High. And he is going to give us success. You know, it kind of reminds me there in the book of Acts. I think it's chapter 5 with Gamaliel. You know, with Peter and John and preaching the gospel. And he says, if this thing is of God, you can't stop it. You know, you can't stand against God. His will is going to be done. And I think Nehemiah was trying to point out to his enemies, no, we don't just have the backing of King Artaxerxes. We have the backing of a much higher authority, that God himself is with us in this work. And so what do you make there of his last statement to these enemies in verse 20, that you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem? What do you think he was trying to say to them?
The God promised to Abraham that this is their land. They're not, you don't, God gave it to the Israelites, and you don't have no say so in the matter. Mm-hmm.
I think that may be part of it. To me, it just seems like he's telling these people, you know, we are God's servants again. We are God's people. We have come back to rebuild his city. And we don't want you know, being part of this. Go ahead, Brother Jim.
You go to chapter 13 where Tobiah has a chamber in the temple.
Yes.
And also where Nehemiah had to lock the gates because other people were coming in and doing business on the Sabbath. This was Israel's city. It was not theirs. And as you mentioned earlier, this is the city of God. It's not just any city where you can bring your commerce and you can come and have a chamber in the temple. You have no part in this, only the children of Israel.
That's a good point, Brother Duke.
And God's always wanted his people to be holy, just like he's holy. They're separate. And after the wall was finished in chapter 6, in verse 16, it says, "And it happened when all our enemies heard of it, and all the nations around us saw these things, that they were disheartened in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was done by our God." still giving glory to God.
That's right. One, James Smith, in his book, The Books of History, just talking about that last phrase there, verse 20, said that they, these enemies of the people and of God, they had no past, no present, no future with the people of God. You know, Nehemiah was smart enough to know these guys didn't want to help him. And we'll see that more in a couple of weeks in chapter 4 and chapter 6. Kind of reminded me, if you go back to Ezra chapter 4, and we didn't look at this part of Ezra in this class, but when Zerubbabel and the people that returned with him came back to rebuild the temple, it tells us there at verse 1 that the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the people of the exile were building a temple to the Lord God of Israel. So they approached Zerubbabel and the heads of fathers' households and said to them, "Let us build with you, for we, like you, seek your God. And we have been sacrificing to him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us up here. But Zerubbabel and Jeshua and the rest of the heads of fathers' households of Israel said to them, 'You have nothing in common with us in building a house to our God, but we ourselves will together build to the Lord God of Israel as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us.'" So kind of a similar response here. You know, you're not a part of us. We know that you really don't have our best interests at heart. You're just coming in here trying to make trouble. And I think leaders have to be aware of that, don't they? Again, those of us who lead our physical families, we have to be aware of dangers. And we're going to talk about that more from chapters 4 and chapter 6 to our family. For those who are leaders of God's people, elders in a local church, you have to be aware of dangers, you know, to the flock that you are leading. And there can be some, as Jesus talks about, you know, sheep in wolves' clothing that try to come in and maybe try to present themselves. Well, we're here to help you. We're here to help you grow. We serve the same God that you serve. You know, give a good speech. But really, on the inside, they are there to do damage to God's people. And so we as leaders have to be on guard for that all the time. Go ahead, James.
So I can see wisdom in from verse 12 that, you know, it says that he didn't tell anybody what had God had put into his heart. And so he gets down to verse 18, and then he starts telling them. But he had those 3 days that he's walking with the people that he selected, that he's listening. See, he didn't explain to them why he's evaluating. They're guiding him, but I'm sure they're having conversations as well. So he's collecting that information. So there's a lot of wisdom in that he's taking that time to listen before he starts to explain. So then he can come to these conclusions that he has about some of these people. Because he's listened.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. So we'll pick up talking about some more specifics with the enemies there again in chapters 4 and 6. Thank you so much for your participation.